Welcome to the Private Practice Made Perfect podcast with me, Kathy Love. I'm a business coach who helps allied health professionals run powerful and profitable businesses in the disability sector. Join me for cutting-edge interviews with leaders in the allied health and business fields, along with plenty of practical content that you can use to make your business practice perfect.
Hello, everybody. Super, super cool guest on the podcast today. Well, all the guests are super cool, but this one has been a bit of a catch because it's all happened so quickly. Donna McGeorge is the author of the book I've been raving about for the last little while, The First 2 Hours. She will also tell us it's not her first book. There's also a fabulous book about the 25-minute meeting and lots of other good stuff. Welcome, Donna.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Pleasure, pleasure, pleasure. So you're an author and a trainer and a facilitator and what else?
Oh, I'm a coach, I'm a mentor, I probably should say I'm a mother, I'm a wife, I'm a doodler, lots of things.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I read The First 2 Hours, I think I told you this the other day, I read it on a plane from Brisbane to Melbourne and I read it again about a week later and I've done some Facebook Lives about it and I've, you know, really got it out there. I absolutely loved it. What was your motivation behind writing it?
As for many things, the biggest one was my daughter joined the corporate workforce not that long ago. She's 27 now. Mm. And so she's been working for about 5 years. And she came home and started talking to me about work and what she was experiencing and difficulties. And my brain was like, nothing's changed. Nothing's changed. And so I started to think so all my inspiration for my workplace stuff is her and trying to give people the help they need to be able to just make work work because we spend so much time there. And so that was one part of it. That's a huge inspiration for my work, is trying to make workplaces better for her. And the other is I get asked a lot. You seem to get through a lot. You seem to be able to, you know, write books, run a business, still be fairly cheerful and not stressing and, you know, tearing your hair out. So how do you do it? And I did a bit of analysis of how I work. Then I looked at the science and the research and the new thinking from a neuroscience perspective and went, I reckon I'm onto something here. Yeah. This idea that for years we've been sold this idea of looking for stuff that's urgent and important, whereas, you know, what happens if everything's urgent, like it is these days, and not much given to when should we do work, like energetically, when is the best time to do our work? So two of those things. One, make the world a better place for my daughter, and the other, you know, how can we leverage our time and energy better?
And get more done with less.
Correct.
Yeah. Describe what is between the covers of The First 2 Hours.
Well, there's obviously some setup around just generally how we manage our energy. And so I couldn't write a book about energy without talking about how things like how we fuel ourselves, how we rest and how we move. And I deliberately didn't call it diet and exercise.
Because no, I bet you don't. I wouldn't have read it.
I know, right? You know, most people would have gone, oh, this is going to be one of those books. But it really just is about being mindful of how you move and how you fuel yourself for the outcome that you're looking for. So I just ate a cupcake there. I said it. So I'm not all about, you know.
One.
Being weird. Exactly.
Now all I can think about is cupcakes. Thank you for that.
You can eat them like cupcakes. Yeah, no worries. Sorry. So that's kind of the first little bit. And then the second part is how you divide your day up into four pieces, the first 2 hours, second, third, and fourth 2 hours. Mm-hmm. And what is given your energetic and your energy and your chronotype and your body clock and all of that stuff, what should you be doing in each of those quadrants? So that's the bulk of it.
Let's take each quadrant. So the book is aptly titled The First 2 Hours because
that's the most important time of the day. And research, so there'll be some people listening right now that are saying, I'm not a morning person, I'm more of an evening person. And I would say that those types are more rare. So about 75% of us tend to have we have more energy. And in fact, our body, from an evolutionary perspective, is designed to be more mentally alert in the morning and have more physical dexterity or capacity in the afternoon. And so whether or not you're an early bird or a night owl doesn't matter. Your body's designed for mental work in the morning and physical work in the afternoon. And so what tends to happen is people, all of us are involved in the information world now, knowledge world. And so most of our hardest work is thinking work, and we really should be doing that in the morning. And so the first 2 hours is when we should be doing our best, most highly valued, high impactful work, not email, which is what we tend to do. We come in, mindlessly go through email, right?
I loved your commentary on email. It just keeps popping up. Evil mail.
Indeed.
So what are the core activities in the first 2 hours?
It's always going to be different. So I was working with a group recently of photographers, and the first 2 hours for them, the most important thing they should be doing, because it's what is going to have the most impact on your business and what requires the most mental capacity. And so for them, it was doing some editing of photos, following up on sales, those kinds of things. For any of us who work in corporate world, it's going to be, you know, maybe you've got a big presentation coming up and you want to block off those 2 hours to work on the slides and work on your scripting and make sure that you're going to nail that presentation. If you have to make some big decisions, there's a whole bunch of studies done that if you have to make important decisions, best to do them before midday. If you don't, you could be suffering from decision fatigue. So there's some really interesting studies around that. And so just basically anything where I need to use my head, and I want to, and it's going to have a big impact on my world.
The numbers work.
Yeah.
All your money stuff, your performance numbers, business planning.
Yeah, just the stuff that, you know, if we were talking Stephen Covey, we might say big rocks.
Yep.
You know, the things that if you, you know, if you do them first and you do them well, they'll have a tremendous impact on the rest of your life. Day, life, whatever. And so, you know, some people will say, oh, I have to do email at the beginning. And I would say, look, the emails you would do in the first 2 hours are the ones that require a really considered response, and you need to think about it and concentrate on it. So it's okay to do them then. But that's only about 10% of your email. The rest of it we just leave till later in the day.
Yeah. And sitting in email is a ton of stuff that shouldn't be in email, I believe. So there's a ton of in-house communication that happens in email, and I would like to stick my neck out and sort of say that stuff should be happening in Asana or Slack or some other communication app where it's channeled and it's sequential and you're not hunting and using that search box at the top of your email to find the thread of things.
So I think agree.
Yeah, I think you can reduce your email load really nicely. Obviously, don't unsubscribe from your newsletter or mine, but all of the other ones.
If anyone's listening who is subscribed to me, permission granted to unsubscribe, because most of what you'll find, what I do is I actually do unsubscribe from emails because I get a lot of my content now, as you say, in other forms. Yeah. So if I want to read your stuff, I'll follow you on LinkedIn or I'll follow you on Instagram or Twitter or on Facebook. And that's, and I actually do a lot of my consumption of that stuff sitting in trams on the way to and from meetings, in the gaps, and when I'm on the couch, you know, watching back episodes of Star Trek, I'll sit there for our social media, right?
That took a dive.
Did it? Sorry. Sorry.
Okay. God.
Do you want to edit that bit?
On that, it's gone from cupcakes to Star Trek. All good. So email is just such a trap, and it just shoots people's blood pressure up. And I could imagine it would be quite a learning curve to learn to glance at email and pick out the one or two things that do have to get done in the first 2 hours. But to practice that surveillance is very, very liberating.
I completely agree. Now, I actually think a lot of people already do this. They just don't realise it. And so there's a large percentage of people that grab their phone the moment they wake up in the morning. And so it's literally by the bed. And so what often they'll do is they wake up, they pick up the phone, and they open their email, and they already glance and just check, you know, what's going on. Then most people put the phone down, go off and, you know, shower, dress and get ready for work and blah, blah, blah. And then they get to work and away they go. And so I actually don't think it's as tough a shift as we think. there's a couple of things. You know, kind of back to your point around all the internal email that comes from various internal functions being done better in some kind of internal social media or group collaboration tool. There's a couple of things that come with that. One, then the onus is on me when I want the information to go looking for it, and I have to let go of a little bit of a sense of entitlement. So a lot of the email that we get has come from people saying in organisations, I wasn't informed, no one communicates with me, and so we get bombarded with that stuff. And so IT are going to do some maintenance at some time and they need to let everyone know. So I think there's a sense of responsibility. So with no email comes great responsibility. We have to go looking for that stuff. And the second thing is, I reckon we just need to, you know, compartmentalise that. And so Outlook, you know, is so great in terms of how it can organise and automate and all that sort of stuff. So I don't think we use that enough. I think many of us are still from the olden days when email was pretty clunky. Now it's amazing. It can do so much to help you be automated. And so I think there's a couple of things there that I think we need to think about, but also be mindful that we are a bit addicted to it. And so it's a habit that we've formed of coming in and doing email first. And I reckon there's an opportunity for us to just start a new habit. I've just been reading James Clear's book, Atomic Habits, which is amazing.
I haven't read it yet.
Oh, look at that. Oh, no, seriously good. And also Charles Duhigg, who wrote The Power of Habit. Both of them talk about substitution rather than stop or
depletion. Yep.
And so instead of doing email, it's plan what you're going to do in those first 2 hours so you don't end up trapped in the letting email run your day.
Yep. So that first 2 hours you describe as being proactive and it's about high impact task and high intensity work. What does the next 2 hours look like? You describe that as being reactive.
So most of us, particularly if we're leaders, we have to be able to respond to our team's needs. They need stuff from us. People need our smarts in organisations. Mm-hmm. And so if you remember, I said that the morning is for mental activity and the afternoon's for physical activity. We've still got capacity in the morning. So that's where I say that's where you open yourself up for meetings. That's where if your team members need their one-on-ones to work on projects and talk to you. So you can actually, I've still got the mental capacity to share my smarts with the world, but it might be that it's important to them, not as important to me. So it would be really easy. So again, you know, I don't mean to throw stones because I'm a big fan of Stephen Covey, but he talked about things that were important and not important. And for me, it's like, I just can't imagine a workplace anymore where anyone is doing anything that's just not important.
Yeah.
Just who it's important to. Yeah. And so in that second 2 hours, you're allowing yourself and you're being open to other people have stuff that they need from me. And so I'm going to make myself available to them.
So potentially team facing.
Yep.
Meetings, communication, performance, troubleshooting, hopefully not too much. But the door's open. I think the first 2 hours, the door's closed. Hopefully you have a door to close. But the second 2 hours is door open and you're up for it. And it's not your agenda. It's actually, as you said, reactive.
Someone else's agenda. And look, I really love your thinking around, you know, I might shut the door in the first 2 hours and then open the door. So that kind of got a bit of legs, you know, again, there was a period of time where open door leadership, et cetera, was a big thing. And so I'm a huge fan of door closed time. And even if you're in an open plan where, you know, no one has offices, which is very common these days, your team will get to know when you've got closed door energy about
behavior.
Right. And so you set the boundaries around that. So they know that at this time of day, best not to interrupt, because very shortly there's going to be it's going to be their turn and it's going to be okay. But you, as the leader or manager or even just anyone working, you can set those boundaries.
Yeah. So you describe it in your model as that second hour as being high intensity but low impact activities. I love that model. I'm just saying, I've got a legal photocopy of it enlarged on the wall, but I won't tell you or your publisher about that copyright breach. Oh, so it's a thing. Cool.
So what you don't need to have an illegal photocopy. I'll pop one in the post to you. And in fact, I'm sorry that it didn't end up. If you buy the copy in the shops, you don't get it. If you happen to get it from me or it's handed to you from me, we've got this little card that we have that has that master model on it. And it's actually designed to, you know, stick on someone's desk so that they can see what they should
Good.
So I'll send you a bunch of those so you can.
Cool. You know what? You could develop a scorecard on top of that.
Look, I reckon I could. I've had lots of people give me some advice around how I could even make it swivel. So if maybe you're not a morning
person. Gamify it.
Yeah, I know. Like maybe we should gamify it. Anyway,
we digress. So then lunch happens. So I can't remember whether this featured in your book. I'm a big fan of lunch. It is this bright yellow thing that sits in my calendar. One of my mentors told me to put lunch in, luckily, a couple of years ago. And most days I do get out and do something resembling lunch. What do you come across in your training about lunch habits for people or lack of?
So most of the time in a Western culture, and I, you know, quote unquote Western culture, we're really slack about lunch. And so we'll work through lunch. We'll say, let's have working lunches. It's almost like anyone who chooses to take a lunch break is almost this, lucky you getting to take a lunch break. It's there's disparaging remarks or something. Now, I learned the value of lunch when I lived and worked in China for a couple of years. And in China, lunch is sacrosanct. At 12 o'clock, the place empties out. And the only people sitting at their desk are the foreigners who have, you know, who are sitting there having a lunch meeting over the phone or something. And so I learned that you block that time out. No one ever books a meeting. And there's two things you do, or actually three things you do around lunch is A, you go have something to eat. And generally it's nutritious, something. So the Chinese are really good around their food, in my experience, you know, genuine Chinese food, not some of the rubbish we get here. The second thing is you go for a walk, so you get out in nature somehow. Mm. And the third thing you do is have a nap. I know, it was glorious. It took me a while to get into this groove. The guy who was a Chinese guy would come back from lunch next to me and he'd put his head down on his desk for, you know, about 20 minutes and just have a little nap, and then he'd be up and go for the afternoon, like, you know, ready to go. And I just think we foreigners, Westerners, could learn a lot from that way of operating.
Yeah. So in your training, do you see people taking lunch breaks like this?
As in when they're my participants in training?
Yeah, when you're working and consulting, is lunch just...
Lunch is a time. So as a professional trainer, if I'm front of room and I'm running a class, often lunch is seen as the time to go and catch up on my real work. And so they'll spend the morning with me doing some stuff. Lunchtime, they'll disappear back to their desk, do a bunch of work, then come back to me, shoving a sandwich down their mouth, ready for the afternoon session.
Oh, wow.
But in corporates generally, I remember one client I was working with, they were taking a lunch break. And I said, we were working in the city in Melbourne, in the CBD. And I said, go take an hour and just wander around the city. And they looked at me nearly blankly, like, what do you mean? So just go for a walk. Mm. And they'd never taken more than about a 10 or 15 minute break at lunch.
Mm.
And so I just find that crazy that we don't do that, that we don't take the break. No one, when you're on your deathbed, no one's ever going to say, thank you, Kathy, for never taking a lunch break.
Yeah.
You're amazing.
Yeah.
No one's ever going to
say that. Spend more time at work. That's right.
Correct.
A lot of people listening are allied health professionals and run their own businesses, so they're in private practice. And I know when I was in private practice, I never took a lunch break. And I did eventually get older and wiser, and I would disappear down the street. There may have been cupcakes in those 30-minute breaks. There might have been hot chips. There might have been retail therapy. There may have been all sorts of other bits and pieces. But as the years went on in the business, that became more and more important for a variety of reasons. So having a point of comparison of what the day is like with lunch breaks and without lunch breaks, and what the week is like and what the month is like and what the year is like, absolute game changer.
Well, and I'd even say in the work that you and your listeners would be doing, it's like you got to get your own mask on first. Right. And so you cannot be of service and help others if you're not in good shape yourself. Mm. And I would say what you just described there, it was less about what you ate cupcakes, hot chips, whatever, and more that you were taking a break and stepping outside and getting some fresh air and going for a walk. And so that's, I'd be saying, if you have to kind of fold time, I haven't got time to have lunch and then have a break, or have lunch on your break, you know, and go for a walk. That's for me is the win.
Yeah. I reckon you've got a whole book on lunch ahead of you.
You know what? How funny. I'm looking forward to the research on that one.
Yeah, I'm happy to help. The other little lunch thing, because we've still got 4 more hours of the day to talk about, but the other thing about lunch, and I started this 3 or 4 years ago, and I've only failed once or twice, is not to eat lunch at my desk. And so there are those that do have a lunch break as such, but it's sort of managing forkfuls of tuna salad while they're checking emails or catching up on social media or all the rest of it. So it is about a personal definition of what lunch is and what it isn't, and how could it be even more spectacular for you?
Well, look, I think there's something about what happens in spaces. So we anchor different states and thoughts and feelings and stuff. So when I'm sitting at my desk, usually that means I'm in work mode, I'm in email mode, I'm in, you know, whatever that might be. I'm sitting at my desk to do work. And even in my own home office, I've got a couch. And for me, when I'm on the couch, that's like the office is, you know, pretty much one room. But when I go and sit on the couch, that's when I'm taking time out.
Yep.
And so that's, I eat lunch over on the couch so that I don't contaminate, quote unquote, my work space, not just with the state contamination, but even just the crumbs and stuff. And, you know, like your computer doesn't work as well when under the keyboard if there's a few crumbs and stuff under there. So, yeah.
And we'll just quickly drop this in conversation, move on to the rest of the day, but lunch when you're driving. So I've arrived at plenty of meetings and visits with relics of lunch down the front of me. And that is the other place that lunch happens. Whether that's lunch, I don't know, it's open to interpretation, but is a bit of a foxy one.
Well, I think what we need to do is separate having lunch with eating. Right? So if we're saying we're having a lunch break, is a lot different to I'm eating something or eating lunch.
Yeah.
And I would definitely say, I can't tell you how many times I've had a crack at eating something in the car and got there, and sometimes I don't realise it, and I look down all of a sudden and go, oh, my God, there's a big splotch or something down there.
Yeah. Oh, no, sorry, people. All right, so we're back from lunch and we've had a walk and a nap and some dumplings and something uber nutritious. I'm sure dumplings are uber nutritious. They're their own food group in my life. Mm. And then in the afternoon it's low impact, low intensity, but it's active time. So what's that third lot of 2 hours about?
Yep. So I gave it the label of active because it's two things. It's about now is when if we tried to sit at our desk and do work that required concentration, we're going to feel dopey and sleepy. So people talk about that sleepy slump after lunch. And you can, mitigate that a little bit by taking a walk or having a bit of a nap just after lunch, and you can kind of be a bit more active. But our actual body clock and our body is designed for more active stuff. And so this is when I say do something that requires maybe a bit of physical activity. So filing, not many people file these days. I had people talk about shredding. I had the other day, I had a big pile of things that needed hole punching. Perfect time of day to do that, sit and hole punch. So repetitive, routine kind of tasks are the best to do where I don't need to think that much. And it's interesting, even though I say they have low impact, I reckon just about everything has impact in your world. So, again, it's a little bit like Stephen Covey saying things that aren't important. But it's the things that you just shouldn't do in the times when you want your brain to be more active.
Yeah. Still satisfying activity, purposeful satisfying activity.
Correct.
Yep.
And this is where I reckon you should process your email. So I think there's a difference between replying to email and processing email. And so, again, if we separate those out, processing email is I go through delete, file, unsubscribe, quick reply of yep, nope, got it, thanks, all of those kind of things. You can do that after lunch. Then the big response to the big question from a big client or a boss or something like that I would leave that until the following morning if I have got the if I can, if there's no urgency around it.
Yeah. And because it's got movement, it could also be maybe some walking meetings and some walking catch-ups and using the movement part of the agenda of the day to get some lighter, habitual, repetitive things done. I love a walking meeting. Is this a good spot for it as well?
Absolutely. Now, I reckon walking meetings fit just about anywhere, but they're particularly good here. And I sometimes think we just forget them as an option. So particularly, I think they're best with one-on-one. So anytime you're meeting just one other person, why not take it for a walk? Mm. And I have seen people do group meetings around that as well, or meeting while standing up, or, just get moving, be active. So you'll often see back in the kind of mid to late 90s, it was very trendy to have, you know, ping pong tables and stuff like that in workplaces. And then they kind of died away for a little bit. And now they're just starting to see a resurgence as people get that this afternoon time, that's the perfect place to go and have a game of ping pong with your mate, down in the rec room or the lunch room, because again, it gets the blood pumping ready for our second wind.
Processing food and all of that stuff. Beautiful. And then there's the last 2 hours, which in my experience, I haven't always done this well. This has been one of my more recent habits in the last kind of few years. But I have a bit of a hunch that this could be really missed. And if you haven't managed the two lots of 2 hours prior to this, you're kind of on the catch up and your blood pressure's going up and you're trying to pack the whole day into 90 minutes because you haven't allocated energy across the day. So I love this part of the day, the last 2 hours. It's low intensity, high impact, and it's about being pre-active.
Yes. So it's about preparing yourself to be the best you can to get kind of the momentum going for the next cycle of time. First of all, you will get a second wind of energy. So the body's designed that you'll start to see an energy surge again. So you'll start to feel a little bit more energetic. So you have got to, even though I say it's low intensity, there will be some increase in mental capacity again. But it's the time when you should, if you're following the model, and it might take you a while to get on the cycle, the reverse of a vicious cycle, the positive, first 2 hours cycle, then this last 2 hours is clean-up time. So it is just got to wrap up a few last-minute things. I might just check my email once more in case something urgent has happened. But really it's about how can I organise my life, my day, both professionally and personally, to be able to give myself the best start to the next day.
Yeah.
And so I actually now I'm in such a habit of this, I can't fall asleep now without deciding what I'm going to wear the next day because I don't want to wake up in the morning. And many of your listeners will have had this moment where you're standing in your jammies in front of the wardrobe that's full and chock-a-block full of
stuff. But there's nothing to wear.
I've got nothing to wear. And so I always decide before I go to bed and I hang it separately so I don't have to think about that. I decide what I'm going to eat. If I'm taking lunch or something like that, I'll always have that ready to go the next day. Mm-hmm. If I'm going somewhere different, I don't know where I'm going. If I'm driving somewhere differently, I'll figure out the route the night before so that when I get up, I'm good to go.
There's other parts of it for me personally, and that's what I call closed loop thinking. So stuff I might have started and earlier in the day or the week or whatever, but just hasn't landed. I've just wanted some brew time on it. It's really cool to close down as many of those loops as possible so that you don't have that stuff spiraling when you are trying to wind down across the day. I also like to look into my calendar for the next day or even a few days later and have all of that scheduled, but to have also done a little bit of the mental work for the next day, so sort of getting preactive on the thinking about the tasks coming up. Closing things down, I might want to check some numbers around things. I might want to check in with my team about where they're up to and sort of close their days down a little bit. We might also need to slate what still is open and needs to be done sooner rather than later. And so for me, it is the best possible chance of A, having a good day, like a good day starts the night before, but it's also about closing the work, Kathy, down for the best possible chance of a half reasonable evening with family or friends or whatever else. And I just don't think this stuff's done well.
Well, you know, you've hit on another inspiration for the work that I do. You know, when I'd be working with a client and I'd hear them say things like, this was kind of the inspiration for the meetings book that you alluded to earlier, that they'd say they spend all their day meaningless back-to-back meetings and then have to do their real work, quote unquote, at night. And so by the time they got home, they'd be having to shoo the kids away so that they could finish off the emails and stuff like that. And they'd be kind of, they used to refer to it as their second shift. So they do their first shift at the office and their second shift at home. And I just think that's just not right. Like, and so that was the inspiration for writing that book. And so if you think about the four quadrants of the day, you know, if any of your people who are, any people who are listening are thinking, well, when am I supposed to have meetings? You know, my suggestion would be you probably should try and only have three or four meetings a day, right? Mm. And I would say that they're sandwiched, pardon the pun, over lunch. So some before lunch that need high-level thinking, some after lunch that don't need much, that might just be routine meetings. Yeah. But leave your morning and your afternoon for the good work. Right,
for the stuff. Tell us a bit about your theory on meetings.
Gosh, where
to start? In polite language.
Well, I don't even have to tell you about mine. I can tell you that most people, when they hear the word meetings, roll their eyes and groan. That, you know, there's too many of them. They go for too long. We don't know what we're there for. Wrong people are at some and the right people aren't at some, all sorts of things.
Well, there's a lack of meetings about core business.
So usually if anyone's complaining about a meeting, it's because they don't really understand the purpose. I think it all comes back to the root cause of, I don't understand the purpose of the meeting. I just did a blog this week on, are we meeting or are we governing? Because often we've forgotten that the purpose for a meeting often is because there's a piece of work we're doing and this is the governance forum we have for managing that piece of work. Mm-hmm. And I think we've kind of lost a little bit of that. So I agree, meetings have to happen. We absolutely have to do them. Yeah. I just think we could do them better. I think we could do them in half the time and I think we could double the impact, which is the tagline of my other book, The 25-Minute Meeting.
Why 25 minutes?
So I piggybacked on the back of all the research done by a gentleman called Francesco Cirillo, who wrote a book called The Pomodoro Method.
Let's get into that.
I know, right? It's really cool. And he discovered that he tested a whole bunch of times across, you know, testing people doing work and how accuracy, focus, all sorts of things were measured. And the magic number he came up with was 25 minutes as the period of time that people, if they did work in 25-minute bursts, stopped for a 5-minute break and then did another 25-minute burst, they were way more productive and got more done. So I wrote both of my books using his method. I don't mean to sound boastful, but I wrote both of those books in 3 months, from conception to finished manuscript in 3 months, which if anyone out there is thinking about writing a book or tried to write a book, that sounds nearly unheard of. It was that very focused productivity. And so I just, sorry?
Can be done.
Absolutely. And so I just went to his thinking and thought, well, how can we apply that to meetings? So then I started looking at research around distraction, around focus, some of the newer thinking from a neuroscience perspective around related to focus and multitasking. And some of the times varied from 18 minutes to 25 minutes. And so I landed on 25. And then I've been running 25-minute meetings for years. So I then put it all together in a book to help the good people of the world.
Oh, amazing. So how do you apply the Pomodoro technique in your everyday goings on?
It's often in the first 2 hours of the day if I want to overlap them. So if it's important to me to bang out 2,000 words for my book because I'm very scheduled about how I, you know, very methodical about how I write my books. Yeah. And so I'll say, right, so the first 2 hours tomorrow I'm going to dedicate to writing, and I'll split that into four Pomodoros.
Okay.
So four 25-minute chunks. And the five-minute break, you know, you guessed it, I get up
from
my
desk.
I go to my couch, I take a break, and then I come back, right?
Yeah. You've actually, and when they mean five-minute break, it is step away from the work.
Yeah. Now, I do allow myself sometimes a quick flick through Instagram. That, for me, has taken a break. Usually, though, 5 minutes is about enough time to go to the bathroom, pop the kettle on, make a cup of tea, grab a cupcake, and get back into it.
Yeah. And it's the break that actually gets you hungry for the next 25-minute sprint as such.
Well, yes, and there was some research done a long time ago by Frederick Winslow Taylor, who did all the time in motion work. Mm. And he found that even with physical work, so we're talking mostly about mental work, but he even found with physical work it was a similar model that I think he did a study where they were loading iron onto the back of railway carriages. And so he found that the men who loaded for 25 minutes and then took a 35-minute break and then did another 25 minutes and a 35-minute break, their capacity was 600% higher than people that did a full day with a 15-minute break, a half-hour lunch and a 15-minute break. Yeah. And so this idea of bursts of work, we're nearly designed for it physically and mentally.
Yeah, cool. I run Pomodoro a little bit differently, similar but differently. I block out parts of my day where I'll work that method for maybe an hour, maybe two at the most, because I just forget to stop. Yeah. And I have timers, but I'm sort of in flow when I just overshoot the timer, whereas I'm learning that the value is in the stopping. But I run it on 25-minute tasks, but I also run it on 50-minute tasks and then have a 10-minute break. I don't know if I'm just a bit slow to get going with the thinking, but once I get going, I actually resent the having to stop bit. So I've stretched it out to 50 minutes. And it works really well, but I only do it for about 2 hours at the most because I just get myself so confused and I often need to work on to some other things. So, it's good fun.
Francesco Cirillo would agree with you. He'd say that you shouldn't do more than four Pomodoros before taking a good solid break, so a good half-hour break.
Yeah. Yeah.
Donna McGeorge would say, whatever works. So we're all so different and unique. So my books are all written around the, I wouldn't say lowest common denominator, but the most common. So our bodies are designed for it, but of course we're all different. We're evolving. We don't know the impact of all of that yet. So I would say if you've got a system that works and you are as productive as you want to be, you're not tired, you're getting done what you want to get done, you're achieving results, and I'd say keep doing it. If, however, you kind of got to the end of the day and you didn't quite get done what you wanted to, then I'd say try something else. You know, if 50 minutes with a 10-minute break works, keep doing it. If it doesn't, try 25 plus a 5-minute break.
I guess it comes back to having that awareness of managing your energy rather than your time. And awareness about what serves you and what doesn't, and definitely that awareness about having your door, the value of having your door closed, and that is okay.
Yeah, that it's okay to focus. And so in modern workplaces, we don't always have the capacity to shut a door, but we do have the ability to whack in some headphones.
Yep.
So that's kind of the new my door is shut signal. That you see someone with their headphones in, that's usually a sign that I'm going to have to quite interrupt, which is no different to knocking on a door, right, because you're going to have to pull the headphone out. So there's some things we can do to signal that we want that quiet time, and I'm all for it. And all the new science suggests that there is no such thing, in effect, of successful multitasking. We end up doing both of them half as good.
Yep.
And then doing one well.
Yeah, yeah. Before we hit record a little while back, you sort of said, oh, is this video? Will everyone see my post-it notes? And then we both compared. You can't really see my post. Well, you saw some of my post-it notes. So we are equal first in the use of post-it notes. How do you use them?
So for me it's about, it's kind of a spin-off the visual planning and tools that are used in the lean lean manufacturing models. So I spent a bit of time with a couple of automotive manufacturing companies and wandering around their plants, and I would see these big boards with all their visual planning and stuff on them, and I got really, that really floated my boat. So that's one aspect. The second is, like about 80% of us, I'm a visual person. And I find calendars and apps and all of that useful when I'm on the tram, but when I'm actually wanting to think and plan and project, and I need to see the whole picture in front of me. And so what you're seeing, if the listeners were looking behind me, is my whiteboard in effect that's just got my major projects and then all the little elements of that, and they're kind of color coded. But as I mentioned to you again before we hit record, I said I also have a Moleskin notebook, and I carry that with me everywhere, and I write stuff down. And on the one hand, that's because just, you know, call me old-fashioned. On the other, science tells us that remember and do 45% more if you write it down.
Motor memory.
Correct.
Motor memory. So you're familiar with Kanban principles?
A little bit.
Okay.
Not enough to at all comment right now, just a little bit. Yeah.
But that is all, that came out of Japanese manufacturing in the 50s, 40s and 50s, and that is about making workflow visual, but also limiting the work in progress, so that rather than the overwhelm of having everything flashing at you from a post-it note, is to pull down the 10 for the week, the 3 for the day, and the one thing you're working on right now. So
love it. And so now that you've said that, I would say, yes, I am familiar with that because I hadn't clustered it there. There's two things I love about it. So a guy called Dr. Jason Fox wrote a great book called The Game Changer. And it was the key principle in it is making progress visible as a motivator.
Yeah.
So a lot of people are motivated when progress is visible. I don't really mean to do this, but I'm going to do a quick kind of plug for a book that's in conception right now, but it's the third book in my series of, you know, the 25-minute meeting, the first 2 hours, and it's going to be called The Next 2 Weeks. And it's exactly that concept, just what do we need to do in the next 2 weeks? Because, again, my little manual process is I think about the next 2 weeks of what I need to get done. And every night I think about what I've got to do the next day, but mostly I've got my horizon set for what's happening over the next 2 weeks.
Ooh, love it. Have you heard of a guy called Jim Benson?
No, should I?
Yeah, I can't scamper off and get his book, but his work is all about personal Kanban.
Oh, I love it.
Yeah, he's really cool. I've done some training with him, and I'm spending some more time with him in November as well. And that's all about how you pretty much take a 12-month business plan right down to 20-minute Pomodoro tasks. Happy day.
I think he and I would get along just fine, don't you?
Yeah. He's very, very cool, super smart, just hilarious presenter. He doesn't get out here very often, but the book is kind of good, and the website gives you a few clues as well. So, All righty. So you get the talking stick to kind of close this racy conversation out. What are your suggestions for busy self-employed people regarding their energy and time and task?
Well, I'm going to come back to the good old, you know, put your own mask on first. Sometimes when you're a people helper in whatever context that is, we tend to put other people's needs and priorities first, and then it's not until we're collapsing with the latest flu or bug or head cold that we realise maybe we should have been taking a bit better care of ourselves. Mm. And so my advice is always going to be, what are you doing each week to take care of yourself? And because I'm not a huge, you know, diet person, I am going to say, and if that's grabbing a cupcake to spoil yourself, it's not so much the eating the cake, it's the time out to sit and enjoy. You know, it took me about 10 minutes to eat the cupcake because A, it was so pretty, I didn't want to destroy it to start with, but I ate it with a spoon, so I wasn't just shoveling it in my face, and there was the mindfulness of that experience. And so I think that's, when we talk about the difference between lunch and lunch, I think that's what we're talking about. So are we taking care of ourselves? Are we, you know, what are we doing on weekends? So if we're busy 9 to 5, Monday to Friday, what are we doing on the weekends to recharge our batteries? I'm a huge proponent of sleep. Our bodies are designed for sleep.
One of my superpowers.
Yeah, it's my superpower. People say, Donna, how do you do what you do? I'm like, I sleep every night, 8 hours. And I do solidly. And I know what interferes with my sleep to avoid. And I know what helps my sleep to do more of. And so, I mean, I don't mind a glass of wine from time to time, but I know the moment I have a glass of wine, I'm probably not going to sleep as well. I'm not going to feel as good in the morning. Yep. So I'm very, very choiceful about when I sleep.
Sure.
I'd be saying, take care of yourself, sleep well, have mindfulness moments and self-care is critical.
The daily cupcake moment is what I've just written down.
Maybe there's a book in that.
I hope there's a cupcake at least.
Someone said to me, I was at, where was I the other day? Oh, that's right. I was doing the audio book for one of my books, so doing the recording. Mm-hmm. And at the end of every chapter, the end of the first chapter, I said to the sound guy, I need to pause for tea. And he said, that's your next book. So it's pause for tea, maybe it's pause for cupcake, so we can all pause for whatever we need to from time to time.
Absolutely love it. Thank you so much for sharing up your wisdom. We've got to make sure that you come back and talk to us when this next book is ready to go. So thank you, Donna.
Absolutely my pleasure, Kathy. Thanks for having me.
I hope you enjoyed today's episode of the Private Practice Made Perfect podcast. For show notes and other resources, please visit practicemadeperfectpodcast.com. While you are there, you can subscribe for future episodes and continue your business adventure with me. And please be sure to share this and other episodes with your friends and colleagues.